your world news headquarters on the World Wide Web. It's time for your daily dose of sanity. This is the Maria Heller Show. Maria Heller is a published author, founder of the Universal Wheel, a lifestyle and philosophy based on our interconnectedness to all living things, a Reiki master, and delivers the news with spiritual views. How many intuitive news decoders, animal rights activists, and vegetarian broadcasters are there? Just one. Maria. Maria has provided independent news for a smart audience for over 14 years now at the Maria Heller Show, available at maria.net.
M-E-R-I-A.net.
And now, here is your host, the mouth that roars, Maria Heller.
Good morning, world. Maria here, alive and kicking. Welcome to the first Tragedy and Hope of my 14th year of broadcasting on the net with my excellent co-host and friend, Richard Grove. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning, Maria. 14 years. Wow, that's a long time.
Yeah, other people claim it, but I'm sure I'm the first and at least the longest show on the net, although there are times I question my sanity about it. I remember way back when I said, oh, this sounds like fun. I'll try it for a few months. And then I said, oh, my God, I was young when I started this show.
I was just talking to a colleague of mine who said, you know, I thought I had like 6 hours of information to convey and that a podcast would be a good format. And now I think he's done 280 episodes. And the truth is, as long as you're learning something substantial and sharing it in a convenient and, transferable way, it's going to have longevity. It's going to benefit people in the future. And certainly having a commercial-free format like what you present and the interesting guests and the interesting books that you get sent that turn out to be the guests on your show, I think it's all just an invaluable archive toward human consciousness.
Absolutely. Got to agree. I remember when I started, I was like, what am I going to do when I run out of material? But that didn't happen. And then I remember when I covered the stolen election of 2000, and I thought that was the biggest story I would ever cover. Man, was I wrong. So, you know.
I think that continues to just show us. It's like even if you on any given day felt like you completely understood history and everything that was going on that day, guess what? You're going to go to sleep and things are going to change and stuff's going to happen and all of a sudden you're going to have to try to catch up again. And it might be a couple years till you get that same, poise and balance to go forward. So it's about how to get those times when we feel like we're really in balance and in sync with our environment closer and closer together to where every day we are feeling like we're on balance and, you know, heading in the right direction.
Right. Well, you know, today is the 68th anniversary of the United States bombing Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And there's a piece of history that a lot of Americans have no idea about. And, you know, I think about the destruction that we caused, being the only country on earth to ever, you know, attack another country with nuclear weapons, even after the war was won. I mean, we just really did it as a show of force, which a lot of Americans don't want to, admit to. And then I remembered, because today they have a lot of pictures of the damage in Hiroshima online. And I think about an article I just got on the radiation pouring out of Fukushima, which they say every hour is equal to 116 Hiroshimas, every hour, going all over the planet. So, you know, in 68 years, it didn't take long for man, you know, for man to totally destroy their environment.
I think that the 68 years have also shown us that we have a culture of fear and that looking into the precedents, I mean, yes, the radiation is awful, but what is the precedent that led American troops to kill civilians en masse? Because that used to be against the rules of warfare. It used to be dishonorable to kill civilians and these sort of things, you know, the rules of war that kind of eroded away in the 20th century. And what it reminded me of was the firebombings that went on in Germany and Dresden and these other targets that we were convinced to bomb civilian targets by the British. So this wasn't even an American idea, but we got infected by a meme that said it's okay to bomb and kill civilians, mothers and children and other people who are innocent and had nothing to do with the war. and that it was okay. And then it metastasizes in a couple years, and the Americans are known as dropping these bombs on Japan, on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And British, you know, the Anglo-American involvement in it is always overlooked.
Right, exactly. And, you know, there are people that still talk of it as the good war. There's an oxymoron, the good war. I know that today, in today's news, there was a story that America finally admitted to using white phosphorus in Iraq, even though the doctors there had been saying that all along, just from the damage on the people's bodies. And it also, you know, is another favorite weapon of Israel's as well. So you look at it and you see what man does to each other, and it's no wonder they don't really give two hoots about the environment.
Well, and the Israelis are also guilty of using white phosphorus against the Palestinians. And so if you examine, you know, what creates this awful weapon of war like white phosphorus or depleted uranium? And the other thing you have to consider is there has to be media and propaganda for people to continually be dehumanized on the other side of the world as targets. I was just reading a very interesting book called The Secret War Against the Jews by former Nazi prosecutor John Loftus, who had one of the top security clearances in American security, intelligence community and NATO. And he has a whole chapter, I think it's chapter 8, about how the Mossad had blackmailed Nelson Rockefeller so that Israel could be created as the state of Israel through and recognized by the United Nations, and that the information that came to blackmail him came through Eleanor Dulles, the sister of John Foster and Alan Dulles.
Who, you know, more than Nazi sympathizes, that's for sure. They're filthy
more
hands.
More than Nazi. They were
everything.
Like Nazi creators. They, like, wrote scripts and financed those scripts, and other people acted them out in Germany. But, yeah, it's pretty crazy to get into the actual history that's available in the books that are written by the people who did this stuff.
In the books that are still available. You know, I'm sure we'll be banning books and burning books quite soon at the rate we're going in Nazi America.
Well, the books that haven't been kindled yet, because what is kindled? It's the starting of a fire, and there is a kindled fire, right?
Mm.
And so this whole idea of them burning books, and wasn't there a time when Kindle like erased 1984, you know, just showed that they could delete an entire book from the library and no one would ever know it was there? I mean, that's like Fahrenheit 451.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, with all this stuff going on, I would say still, you know, now we have this big high terror threat and all this BS. And my thought is, and I agree with Glenn Greenwald, he said, you know, this whole high terror threat that the U.S. has just put out is really, you know, to distract people from the NSA scandal that's out there. When I'm reading about this NSA and all of this, and, you know, whether it's Bradley Manning, whether it's Ed Snowden, you know, there's so many people coming forth. Interesting enough, they're all young people. I think back to the very first time you sent me your material. And I was thinking about, and I believe it was called Silverstream. Do you remember that?
Well, the two-disc set that I sent you is called Project Constellation, A Message to the Future of America. And in there, there was a company that I used to work for called Silverstream Software.
Uh-huh. Right. And you want to talk about Silverstream Software again and what it was purported to do?
Well, basically, it was a dot-com company. So when I went to work there, there was about 300 people. It had just gone public. Had a, you know, stock soared, a bunch of people made money, and then the people who invested in it invest, you know, the stock goes down to $2 or $3. So there was that aspect of it, the Morgan Stanley, Dean Witter, you know, MSDW, taking of Silverstream public. But I came in after all that. So there was just, you know, it's a small company, it's growing, it's providing cutting edge technology to the world's largest financial services institutions, including AIG and Marsh and McLennan companies. And all their subsidiaries for a global license. And Marsh & McLennan Companies was at the time and still is the world's largest insurance brokerage. And at the time, it was the CEO was Jeffrey Greenberg, and at AIG, his father, Hank Greenberg.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, you know, that's a little background on those companies. And as far as what I did there, my job was in sales, and I would have a technology assistant, like a technology guru with me that would be able to speak the nuts and bolts of it. And my job was to interact with the executives and find out what their use cases and needs were. And the technical partner would help to match those needs up to our product and demonstrate the functionality. So in the process of learning what Marsh & McLennan companies sought to do, they sought to move off of the mainframe and what they call legacy hardware platform and to web-enable all these systems to greater facilitate their clients and the trading of risk. Well, one of the shortcomings of making everything electronic is there's no longer a paper trail. When there's no longer a paper trail, you're creating a big gap in oversight and the ability to defraud your clients and your partners, which provably several years after 9/11, Marsh and AIG were found guilty and charged almost $1 billion in fines because they were cheating their clients. But I think they ripped off like $200 billion and they only had to pay like $1 billion. So it was a pretty good profitable deal.
Right, good for them. Now, weren't they also working on some software to predict catastrophic events?
Well, that was the job that I had right following Silverstream. That company was called Panacea, P-A-N-A-C-Y-A software. It was artificial intelligence technology. But while I was at Silverstream, we were building these portals, these web portals that could access data on these legacy systems. And one of the other clients that we used as a reference to get that account was Deutsche Bank. It was Alex Brown Deutsche Bank, or DB Alex Brown. There were several different subsidiary companies. They were, you know, purchased Bankers Trust, I believe, if I remember correctly. And so they wanted these trading systems that would allow, you know, specific trading capabilities that no other companies had at that time. Mm-hmm. And so Marsh & McLennan saw what the Deutsche Bank had, and they're like, we want this thing, but better. And so we built them a custom application that would give them, it was the first connectivity of its kind in the world, and it was between Marsh and AIG, between the father and son company. So those were just some of the things that I saw before I really kind of looked more with more scrutiny at the situation after 9/11.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, they've had a lot of stuff in the works for a very long time is what I want to actually, you know, discuss or make clear to my listening audience. You know, when you look at all this spyware today, people think it's brand new because Snowden just popped out with it. But, you know, before Snowden and the term whistleblower, people were called conspiracy theorists if they ever uncovered anything like this.
Well, sure. And I didn't even know. I had never heard the term conspiracy theorist until several years after all these events happened to me. And then I started looking into what's going on. And then, you know, someone said, well, you're a conspiracy theorist. And I had to go look it up because I didn't know what that was. But in the software world, so yes, in 2000 and 2001, all these big banks and corporations are trying to take everything and put it online and make all the transactions paperless, which creates a lot of room for fraud. Evidence of the frauds are found in Tyco, WorldCom, all these other scandals that happened because data conveniently went missing. Mm-hmm. Congress passed a law in 2002 called the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. And that act mandated regulatory software be installed at all these financial services institutions. And I used to sell that software. That was two jobs after Silverstream. We can talk about that in a second. That was a whistleblower circumstance where I followed the rules. I went through channels. I expired all those channels. And without my evidence ever being contradicted, the evidence never made it to the public, and it was effectively shut down. So the point is, you can go in the court, you can prove everything, you know, beyond reasonable doubt, but you cannot get this information to the public in a useful manner to warn them before it happens. So progressing on from Silverstream, in 2002 and 2003, I worked for a company called Panacea, which I mentioned. This is artificial intelligence software that basically would put a spy on every piece of your infrastructure internally as a corporation for the purposes of risk management. And it would have predictive capabilities after it spent a not significant, like a few weeks, amount of time learning and watching all the traffic and using time series analysis and all these other algorithms to be able to accurately predict outages in your system before they happen. So this is worth a great deal of money to corporations, but from a national security sense, and the chief technology officer at Panacea in the weeks after I left there came directly from the NSA. And that's straight up on his resume. So it's a private company that worked within a stone's throw of Fort George G. Meade, Maryland, which is the NSA. It was cooked up on the naval base in Annapolis. So it was a government-funded place, but at the time I had no idea that, like, you know, any of that stuff was going on. You find this out in hindsight. It was just a sales job for me. It was cool technology, and we were selling it to kind of innocuous customers who just seemed to want to save money. Mm-hmm. But I could only be naive so long in the face of reality. And eventually, when you look back at it and you see, you know, what I said in Project Constellation in 2006, by 2006, I understood that these AI software, you know, private companies were developing a software ultimately to bubble back up to the intelligence community, which could then, it has the potential to chew on everyone's data and make predictive models of individuals for the purposes of harnessing human resources. But they needed all this data to be voluntarily given by the people to these entities. So they created more entities like Facebook and all these other accounts that are out there hacking your life and collecting all this data so that the NSA and these other groups that are privatized and still part of the intelligence community know more about your life than you do for the purposes of control, not to help you, not to enrich your life, not to make it more wonderful. So that's kind of the motivation behind what they're doing with the technology, and that's the juxtaposition to some of my corporate experience around it.
Quite the eye-opener for you, I'm sure, without question of a doubt. But
with such a bright light of truth, you open your eyes kind of slowly because you have to squint at it. It's so, you know.
Well, Richard, like, you had a lot to lose in those days, okay? You were a shining star in the company. You were making, you know, six figures. You were living large. You really did have a lot to lose because, you know, most Americans don't want to lose what little they do have, let alone, you know, stand up and do something right. What prompted you to wake up out of your trance?
To summarize in a metaphorical single sentence, I would say I recognized that there was a British fox in an American hen house and that our country was in severe danger, and in realizing that, you know, there's a lot to be understood in order to understand what's going on. It just seemed like holding on to any of those vestiges of that corporate happy life, it just seemed so trivial to try to go after such superficial things that have been programmed into my, you know, my mind through propaganda and TV and movies when you're in contact with some reality. The reality is people are being attacked in a number of ways every day. It's a full spectrum type of dominance. It's well organized. It's well documented. And that there is a chance to turn things around if we get together and recognize the validity. And once we recognize the validity, we know how to deal with foxes. This country has a history of being able to deal with the fox in the hen house. Mm-hmm. That's how, you know, it's at 1776. And it doesn't need to be a violent uprising or revolution these days. You just need to figure out how they're harnessing you and voluntarily withdraw your consent and then start to reprioritize your time, habits, and whatever type of wealth you have into something that's substantial that contributes to a solution, because without that, people are going to lose their rights, they're going to lose their property, there's not going to be an America, and it's going to be on a technological cybernetic grid lockdown that human beings can't escape in the future. They're going to have to point where there's such a gap between them and us as far as technology and the ability to manage human resources from afar without governments, because they're just going to have a technocracy. It's going to be controlled by computers and smart grids and the collection of all the artificial intelligence data that I was just talking about. All of that is going someplace. They have a plan. They are executing it without much intellectual resistance. Mm. And I just say we all have the ability to use the question mark to learn from that question, move forward, and close that gap faster than they can create it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting you say that because I actually went to the movies this weekend, and I saw Wolverine, pretty good movie. But I saw Coming Attractions for another movie with Matt Damon. I think the name of it is Elysium, something like that.
Yeah. And that's their plan.
Right. And I looked at just the Coming Attraction, and I said, this is exactly what their plan is. So, of course, I'm going to see it as soon as it comes out. But from what I could see, the Earth is basically totally destroyed, people living like animals, like in Soylent Green. And the elite, and they actually say that in the Coming Attractions, the elite live on another planet where they have everything, a beautiful environment. They have, you know, peace. They have lots of, you know, stuff, you know, they're living large. And I looked at that and I said, you know, do people that go to the movies or watch TV understand the programming that they're putting into their heads with the movies that they create? Or the shows that they create?
I don't think people realize it, which is why we recently released a movie called State of Mind, The Psychology of Control, as kind of a first step for the uninitiated to help people understand that they're being exposed to it, and you can choose to put your attention elsewhere, and you can choose to ask questions, and that breaks the control. But I want to talk about Elysium, because I likewise have only seen the trailer. I likewise recognize them, like, this is their template. They've written documents about this, and now there's a it's like a billion-dollar movie, an advertisement for it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Jodie Foster plays someone by the last name of Rhodes, which is a reference to the plan that was created to bring Elysium about, not in fiction, but in reality, to create a one-world government where they have a technocracy and the use of technology to separate the elites from the working class, that they're going to greatly depopulate, to take away population, to kill people, to exterminate by various means. These are in their plans, that the earth is too crowded for all these people, and they are the ones who should survive and make decisions on your behalf. And it reminds me of the company I worked for in 2003, Panacea. The guy who came up with that software was named Earl Cox, and he wrote several books, some on fuzzy logic, which is a type of technology that is not on or off, but there's degrees between on and off. He also wrote a book called Beyond Humanity, Cyber Evolution and Future Minds, which is a transhumanist magnum opus. This is like a plan that Kurzweil would say, hey, I'm on board with that. Stanley Kubrick and Steven Spielberg used Earl Cox's book, Beyond Humanity, as the template for their movie AI, mm-hmm. which is about a little robot boy that never gets old. So, you know, there's an underlying theme to that movie that Kubrick was at least trying to warn you about, which is why I don't think he finished that film and Spielberg did. But that's another conversation.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, I thought AI was pretty intelligent. You know, years ago I used to have a futurist on my show, Dr. Tom Lombardo, and he always said that the goal and what he would see, you know, from his futurist society is their goal was to basically blend computers and humans. But he always felt that eventually computers would inherit the earth. It would be robots and not humans.
And there's no need to have that happen. I mean, we can all exist symbiotically, although we haven't figured it out among human beings yet. So wouldn't that be great if there was this other threat that would help unite us, which is what they're trying to create. It's like these guys saw the Terminator movies, and they're like, that's a great business plan. Let's try that. And if you search DARPA plus Atlas, you can see the latest version of the Terminator robot being built. I have trouble speaking because these ideas are so ludicrous, and yet there they are.
Mm-hmm.
Your tax dollars are being used for the craziest things
that
have nothing to do with supporting you or your family or your life or any of our survival, really. And it's just like our taxes become a private slush fund for people who their actions are sociopathic. I'm not going to, you know, I'm not a doctor, so I'm not going to try to diagnose their mentality, but their actions are sociopathic. They are antisocial. That's by definition, right? They, you know, they're in conflict with individual needs of human survival aside from themselves. And that is violating the volition of others because they have to steal our money to do those things.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I hate to say it. It's not just the United States. Let's not leave out the rest of the world and all their little evil leaders. Because, you know, I think this week Japan launched a robot into space along with a living, breathing astronaut. And they made, of course, the robot look cute, like their art and their
weird
little things.
That's not Japan. We started out the show by, remember, the Anglo-American establishment dropped some big bombs on Japan a long time ago so they could build factories in their image, and Western technology and money could be in Japan. And those people basically got made into a slave population. You know them as like Sony and all these other things that they've produced, right? But that, you know, just like America was used as a slave population just before World War II. And then the bankers and the people who invest, they take it over to Japan. Now, prior to World War II, Allen Dulles, Rockefeller, all these other guys, there's antitrust laws in the United States. They all went to Germany. They started to knit together companies over there to create multinationals that would survive no matter who won World War II. And those are some of the issues that still plague us today, because it's those multinational companies that make accountability locally impossible.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, I saw a poster. It says we have smartphones and stupid people. What do you think about all these smart devices that are supposed to be for our benefit and our convenience?
I think if you use a smart device and you don't know about all the data it's collecting, and, you know, it's a spy. Like, Stalin's gulag would have just loved to have one of these devices so it could just collect all this data. It's like, you know, having a spy on you all the time. So there are many, many, many shortcomings and downsides to all those smart devices. But that being said, if you know about those shortcomings and you can limit them and you do something constructive, creative, and inspirational with it, then I would say, you know, you can use those tools against them. The internet, all this stuff I think is wonderful, because as soon as people start to learn how to use it and ask substantial questions and find valid answers, we can all get on the same page pretty quickly. And so it's nice that our opposition has armed everybody with these devices through which they could be taught a solution or teach themselves through being exposed to things that they didn't know that would help them improve their life and make it more wonderful.
Mm-hmm. So what did you think after your own personal experiences, maybe on a smaller level, but what did you think when Ed Snowden came out and did and exposed what he did? Were you surprised?
Well, I was not surprised. I was very attentive to listen and gather as much information as I possibly could on the situation. But I think that his lack of knowledge of history allowed him to get in some situations where he's now being played like a pawn on the chessboard. And I think from his time at, you know, CIA to, you know, his time at Booz Allen Hamilton, which is the world's most profitable private intelligence company, to his, you know, doing private contracting for the NSA. The NSA has long, since 1974, been spying on American citizens. So for those guys, James Cutter and the other guys to sit up there and say that they're not spying on Americans, okay, are you collecting information on Americans? No, still no? No, you are. That's what a lie looks like, everybody. Okay, they're just lying to you. Understand that. So they've been spying on us a long time, since 1974 at the very least, through the documents. And when you look at Snowden's release of the PowerPoint slides are useful, but they're not. None of us were under the impression. I wasn't under the impression that those companies weren't directly hooked in through the NSA at all. There's like 30, you know, intelligence companies in the community, the American intelligence community, and they all have ties to the Israeli community and the British intelligence community. So they're all kind of knitted together and built with the same dollars and serve the same circles of people at the end of the day, because they're not here to protect us. They're here to manage us, and that's why they need that information, to manage us. So Snowden, I think, is a bit naive. I think he's being played. I think it's convenient that Glenn Greenwald was able to publish that story, and that Snowden thinks that encrypting your email is something that they can't hack through. I think that's kind of cute. I think it's a bit naive. I think
cute.
You're just putting yourself on their platter and saying, oh, here's something of high value that you wanted to, you know, stick your quantum computers on, right? So I don't know if all that went on without the NSA knowing about it, because they could have, they should have. And I don't, you know.
Well, that's what people are saying. If the NSA was spying on everybody and anything, then how did the Boston bombing take place?
Well, let me answer this before we even address the Boston bombing. Let me just tell you about, from my experience working with corporate financial services companies in their IT infrastructure in a secure area, in, you know, even a Walmart headquarters. If you put a thumb drive, if you put a USB, you know, in there, the system, artificial intelligence that we used to sell, watching the system knows exactly who plugged it in, when they plugged it in, what the serial number is, what data was transferred, all this stuff is automatically collected. It's a red flag. Mm-hmm. And so if you're going to expect me to think that Booz Allen Hamilton of the NSA is that lax in their coverage, it's only because they want it to be that lax. Okay?
Right.
So in other words, if they put out a honeypot and Snowden comes along like Winnie the Pooh, and then all of a sudden he can't get his hand out of the jar. I've read that story before, and I'm not surprised.
Hmm.
That's why I learn history every day, so I'm not Winnie the Pooh anymore, because once upon a time I was a whistleblower, and I made similar but different mistakes than Snowden did. I thought I could go through this, you know, you blow the whistle, you tell the audit committee, you go to court, you go to the press.
Right.
No, that's not how it works, everybody. Do not gamble away your future for what you don't know now.
Well said. Well, look at poor Bradley Manning. Look what he's going through. They're saying he's going to do at least 95 years in prison.
There's another dude who got his hand in the honeypot, because for them to let him take things out of there on a thumb drive and then act surprised, I mean, they just want people to know that they're killing, in the Reuters video, they killed those journalists, that collateral damage video that's what Bradley Manning was, you know, first associated with. It's the, you know, Apache helicopter driver, you know, pilots, shooting up the journalists. And I think there was, a man and his kids who had stopped to help. I mean, they just let everybody out because they're all terrorists and they need to be killed, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think if American tax dollars are being spent on that, there should be no problem. Why is anyone embarrassed that we're being shown that? Why did they make a big deal that he leaked that stuff? If America did it and it's right, why are we embarrassed? Why is national security even there in the first place? Like, who are we scared of? And what do we got that's so secret? Oh, all the criminal activity that people would revolt and you know, castigate the government for?
Right.
Oh, that's national security. And look into it. Clark Clifford, 1947, National Security Act. And he was, you know, in charge. He was one of the financiers involved, or the facilitators of BCCI, which is the money laundering scandal tied to Iran-Contra and Al-Qaeda. If we do our history, the people funding all this terrorism are the same people benefiting from it financially. It's easy to find out, and we should all talk about it and become educated in our own way on different aspects.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But, you know, you always have those people, you know, my country, right or wrong. And it's like, are you kidding me? You know,
it's not your country anymore. That's my point. British Fox and the American Hen House, like, they're in control. They've infected our system with their whole ideology to the point where we're worshiping the birth of a new baby. I don't think that's good. I don't think that's a good sign for America. I think that's a test to see how sycophantic people are, and they pass the test with flying colors. It's like, woo, royal baby.
Right. Well, you know, there are a lot of movements. I know. There are a lot of movements in the UK against the rule by, you know, divine rule. Or, you know, being forced who's going to be their king in 2063, this new baby. You know, realizing that, you know, they have no rights and they have no say either. So maybe the world will wake up.
I doubt that any of these people ever woke up. You know, Prince Charles or any of those other characters over there acting like they're in their costumes, like they're royalty. I doubt they ever woke up, asked the legitimate question, how they have a divine right to rule other people and to do as they please and to fly around on jets while they tell us to live in, you know, these little tiny apartments and drive these little cars and do all this stuff. It's like they are hypocrites. They think they have power, and I don't really fault them, but I fault the people around them who buy into it. That creates the problem when there's large groups of people who believe in those things. If it was just Prince Charles, he's like, I'm the prince. Hey, great for you, buddy. Good job. Good.
Yeah, who cares? Right. Yeah. I can't even believe people can still fall into that shit in 2013.
But those are the people that create MI. Like, they created intelligence agencies to do their work. Prince Charles doesn't go get his hands dirty. He sends his people, right? And so that establishment has fully infected all of our intelligence agencies, our State Department, our American population that thinks it's, you know, it's all good to take on all these standards of empire and to be the tip of the spear and to conduct British foreign policy with American tax dollars.
Uh-huh.
Because if you follow Al-Qaeda back far enough, it goes back to the British Empire and Bridger St. John Philby, who helped to establish the Saudi royal family to acquire the rights for the oil fields for BP and Standard Oil. Okay, follow me along. That creates a bunch of money, and they start funding the Muslim Brotherhood in 1928. That has grown through the Mujahideen with Zbigniew Brzezinski all the way through today's Al-Qaeda, which, you know, when you find out Benghazi was a whole operation by the CIA because to cover up them selling missiles from Libya that they had stockpiled to the Syrian Al-Qaeda guys. So Al-Qaeda started this century as our enemy, but now the CIA is providing them with weapons paid for by your tax dollars. So I'm just saying it's time to call a spade and stop, you know, just taking all this stuff for granted. They are lying to us. Let's start paying attention.
Right. Absolutely. Rich, we're going to go to a short break. When we get back, I want to talk about something that I remember was pretty popular in the late 60s. There were a lot of books out about it, too, so I wanted to just talk about how that fits into what we're talking about now. And that, of course, is cybernetics, which was a big movement in the late 60s. Stay with us. Rich and I will be right back.
You're sitting there loving this show. Maria is in her 14th year on the net. Soon, the Maria Heller Show will be heard on David Icke's new network, The People's Voice. Maria's free show is available on site weekly and on Gary Knowles Network each Sunday at www.prn.fm. To really complete your learning experience and have a sense of belonging, be sure to subscribe to Maria's daily shows at maria.net. That's M-E-R-I-A.net. 4 shows a week. Make it a win-win situation. You get to support real truth in media and get educated at the same time. All shows are still commercial-free, so 1 hour of talk is like getting 3 hours of radio. Subscribe now. Now back to this fantastic show.
Okay, welcome back to Tragedy and Hope with my co-host Richard Grove. A lot of you are familiar with Richard's work. If you're not, get over to tragedyandhope.com. Believe it or not, Rich, I get tons of compliments all these years later. People thanking me, even on Facebook, for bringing Richard Grove to the forefront and realizing that I was that person that actually paid attention to what you were bringing out, which to me was mind-blowing at the time.
Well, to me, it was kind of mind-blowing to actually have somebody listen to what I sent or to have the time to take it, consider it and respond, because I felt like each time I was reaching out and trying to send this message out to see if I could get a response, it was like spinning the roulette wheel in a casino, and I had lost so many times spinning this roulette wheel, metaphorically, and I was like, I'll give it one last spin, because I had heard your interview with Eric John Phelps, and I was thoroughly impressed that it was more relaxed, and it wasn't trying, you allowed him to speak his piece, and you gave him space, and I was checking out his work at the time, and I was like, I thought that you provided an environment where it felt like I was sitting in the same room and could observe what he had to say, and you had a good way of bringing that out. So I thought, well, I'm gonna send one more set of these CDs to Maria Heller, and it got to you right before Memorial Day weekend to spoil your weekend.
Hey, it didn't spoil my weekend. It rattled it. I was like, holy crap, when I listened to it. I was like on fire.
If you remember, you had family staying with you, and I think you had to ignore some family visits.
Yeah, I had family. It was a holiday weekend. I had family. I had guests, and I said, listen, I got to work. You got to take my grandkids and just get lost for a couple of hours, because I had to work as fast as I could to get that information out there. And you know what? I think to date, nothing has ever burned my service more than the 12 days of day and night hits on my service when I put that up. And, of course, what really amazed me was all the people that had rejected you were now asking me if they could talk to you, as if I owned you. And I'm like, he's not my son, You can contact him. But I just couldn't understand how anybody could ignore the information you were bringing forth when everybody was so busy looking for answers to 9/11. And here you come with a big chunk of the puzzle, and nobody wanted to hear it, which is kind of typical even till today.
I think it was a natural reaction for people to try to reach out to you, because at that time I didn't have a website. I didn't have any web presence, because all I had ever done was read things on the web. I never really posted anything before. And I wasn't that savvy of posting things. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been sending people CDs. That was kind of legacy software right there, throwing it on a CD and paper. So I wasn't really adapted to producing things to put on the internet or having a website or any of that stuff. So I did make some meaningful connections through the people, some of the people that had inquired to you, and you were kind enough to just forward those to me and not throw out my personal information. That's cool. And I just grew with it. It was a couple weeks later, I did have a website, and then a couple months later, I started the 9/11 Synchronicity podcast,
right,
which was more of using 9/11 as a keyhole through which you can see all this other connected history and points of consideration that weren't being talked about.
Right.
And then in 2009, I started the Peace Revolution podcast, which is more of a curriculum for adults to lay out the broad components of that which we've been denied and kind of create the blind spot in which all these frauds are being perpetrated. So that's my way of trying to fill in that blind spot. It's like, hey, here's a mirror. Look right here. You can see these guys. They're doing these things, and they're controlling the outlets that are supposed to give you the news. So, help us out. We're not, we let everyone, kind of go through our productions for free. But if you like what we put out there, we ask that you support us by joining the community or buying the Ultimate History Lesson DVD set. These small steps help us to continue going. And we do, you know, I produced media for several years before we had anything that we could even charge for in order to kind of support the cost of doing all this research and getting the primary sources. It costs money to get the books from which I get all these juicy tidbits because I'm going to the primary sources. I feel it's a work that benefits all of humanity. Whoever chooses to read into this, we're all being affected by it. There are some people who are interested, and we provide an outlet through which this these points and these nuggets can be purveyed in such a way that they can be also propagated into the future so that the lie can stop here.
Right. But isn't it amazing how, you know, when you look back on your life, and I look at other people too, you just hit on that one synchronistic event that changes your path in this journey for the rest of your life. And I'm not saying or not even sure that the day you sent me that, that information was the turning point for you, but maybe it was. But when I look at my own life, you know, for me, the major turning point was when I met this very humble Native American teacher named Sun Bear. And I got to tell you, my life changed completely from being, you know, a consumer like most people, into, you know, being a person who cared about everything, the environment, this, that, the other thing, spirituality. It just totally put me on a different track than the programmed track that we all are born into.
Well, I think we all start our, like, it's a natural process of unfolding toward the light. And it started with, for me, with a question and then some events and then some more questions. So it seems to, you know, kind of occur exponentially. It starts out really slow and then it starts to get bigger and bigger and you start to realize more and more because you now have context. You can understand, possibly for the first time in your life, because much of what we think we've known, we were programmed with declarative sentences that we didn't question. So it's an awakening process, yes. It's an unfolding. It's a continual evolution. That's what learning is. And I think that's the lesson of life, is that we have the ability to use reason and to learn from our mistakes, to communicate about these things, and to not only consume media, but we also have the power to produce media. And for all too long, we've been letting other people, all the wrong people, produce all the media we've consumed.
Exactly. You know, I don't know if you've gotten a chance to see the movie Operation Terror, but it's a man who produced it. His last name, I think it was Oliver. I have him in my archives. But he put this movie together. It's kind of like what he imagines and who he imagines put together 9/11 as the inside job that it was. So he put out that kind of media. You know, years ago, I remember after the Kennedy assassination, there was a movie and it was stricken from the airwaves for quite some time. But it was a movie that pretty much showed how the assassination of Kennedy went down. You know, seven different trained shooters, et cetera, et cetera. And when I saw this Operation Terror, I compared it to that same type of movie, where somebody comes out and says, no, maybe this is what happened. This makes more sense. And I don't know if you've seen Kevin Ryan's newest book on 9/11. I think about you when I read it because it's called Another 19. And he does go into depth about the trades that were made that day, who made the money. He's got more names and times and places in there, Rich, than I've ever seen in all these years of 100,000 9/11 books. So what you're saying is so important. And I think that's why so many people are self-publishing, because they don't, you know, they understand most of the publishing companies now are owned by the same three big media conglomerates and they're not going to put out the truth. So what you're doing, what all these other people are doing is what we used to say, you know, God, when I started like 14 years ago, be the media. Do you know what I mean? Be the media.
I think we do have to learn how to be the media, but I think before we can be the media, we have to do that part where I said, you know, learn how. Not only how to produce the media ourselves as far as podcasts or video or these other things, but learn how to use the resources that are out there to understand what's going on and to be able to provide substance. One of the reasons that I called our website Tragedy and Hope was after the book Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. and we focus on history, so it seemed like a fitting title, but also because of the information inside that book, which lets you know that, you know, there's this character from Britain who graduated from Oxford named Cecil Rhodes. He was funded by the Rothschild family. He went to South Africa. He's responsible for apartheid, very similar to what's used in Israel today. He's responsible for the De Beers Diamond Cartel, which is a multinational conglomerate that operates outside U.S. jurisdiction and cannot operate in the United States. And yet, diamonds are a girl's best friend, and people think diamonds are related to love through clever PR. Mm. So there's so much of our history that connects back to the legacy that was embedded, the Anglo-American establishment legacy that was embedded into our culture in the 20th century. And bring it forward to something like 9/11, it's like, someone would ask, well, why would you have to go back 100 years to explain 9/11? Well, there's a 100-year history of the terrorists that, you know, they're telling us did it being funded by this other group who's seeking to subvert America. And if you look right now, they're doing a pretty good job because a lot of people have lost faith, and yet you can't really break away from what's going on because it's a gulag-type culture. And so I just want to read the last paragraph in this book that I recently got that kind of ties this all together. The book is called Lord Milner's Second War, The Rhodes-Milner Secret Society, and it's by John Cafferkey, who is a graduate of Trinity College in Scotland.
Uh-huh.
It says, talking about the Anglo-American establishment and the British bankers, they are determined, but determined to do what? I am convinced Americans are deluded if they think Middle East extremists or Muslims are their enemies. There is no external threat. The enemy is within. And then the next page is chapter one, The Secret Society of Cecil Rhodes. So for a couple dollars, this was my first Kindle book. If I'm going to use a Kindle app and go through that proprietary all blah, blah, blah that I don't like and collecting information, yada, yada, I'm going to get a book and let them see. You want to see what I'm reading? I'm reading about you guys. I'm reading about the people that are putting a cage around us, and I'm reading how to break out of this cage. And I'm just, you know, I'm not anyone special. I'm just someone who has had focus and determination and patience and persistence, and I've collected an immense amount of information that I try to purvey out through our various media publications.
Right, which you do well. Let's not leave that out. Cybernetics, I brought it up before the break. When I was, I got to say, I was probably about 18, 19, when cybernetics was the latest rage. I mean, everybody in the big company I work for was reading the book on cybernetics. And, of course, to them, it was all about mind controlling yourself and, you know, better living through cybernetics, you know. And I remember some of my higher-ups trying to, you know, push that on me, too. But I could tell you, you know, at 18 or 19, I really didn't want to hear any of that crap. And how does cybernetics fit into the social control that's going on now, and how is it used that way?
Well, to step backwards from things I've mentioned in this conversation that might help provide a foothold, Earl Cox, who had created the Panacea software and wrote the book Beyond Humanity, Cyber Evolution, and Future Minds, it's about the use of cybernetics applied toward their goal of transhumanism, to live into the future, to upload themselves on the computers, and all these sort of things. Stepping backwards from the future, cybernetics has traditionally, since the time of Plato, it means cybernetes, which means helmsman or steersman or governor. It has been a method and a methodology and a study of how to control the energy and, you know, resources of human beings. How to get people to do what you want them to do so that you don't have to work. It is the philosophy and study conducted by plunderers, and it's conducted with the target of people who produce things and try to be self-reliant and just want to be left alone. I'm talking about the people who won't leave you alone, the people who think that your life is something that they own and can suck the marrow out of, and it's nothing that you should be living on your own, unscripted or self-programming or autonomous. They want to be able to predict your actions, and they do that by programming your behavior through psychological warfare, through mass media, through advertising and marketing. Not that any of those things are different. They're all psychological warfare in most of their current forms. Mm-hmm. And cybernetics in the 20th century, if you collect up some of Zbigniew Brzezinski's books, he's the guy who helped create Osama bin Laden and the Mujahideen, and do an index search on his books for the word cybernetics, you'll see that he's long been a fan of collecting information on people and using it to build predictive models. He lacked in 1968 and 1970 when he's writing his book, Between Two Ages, America in the Technotronic Era, which means post-industrial era, his plans for America needed this new software that could spy on everybody. He needed this new software that would have artificial intelligence capabilities. And so when David Rockefeller reads this, he's like, hey, this is a great idea. How about you and me form the Trilateral Commission? They buy up Jimmy Carter. They get a bunch of banks and Coca-Cola to support him. And then they start to take over the country, and that starts with the NSA spying in 1974, and it comes all the way forward to Snowden. So everything we've talked about in this conversation, as random as it may sound or to an average or, you know, new listener, not a thorough subscriber of media, Maria's content, but, you know, all these things do connect in a meaningful way, and they're a part of an agenda, a macrocosmic agenda, an overall global agenda, through which we've talked about some of the microcosmic aspects like Snowden.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I like when I read something where the government is, you know, against Snowden, you know, they'll say that he put out illegal leaks. You know, when they say he leaked something illegally, then that means there's plenty of stuff that's leaked legally. Do you know what I'm saying? Otherwise, why would they have to call it an illegal leak?
Well, by illegal, they mean unauthorized. And by unauthorized, they're like, does this hurt our ability to lie to the American people? And the answer is yes. So it's unauthorized. It's illegal. It's a leak. He's not a whistleblower. All these things that they want to say. Let's focus on the slides.
Right.
What did he release? Let's step aside. Let's put the messenger aside. Let's look at the message. The message is not necessarily authentic or original, but it does need to be reiterated to the people who don't know it yet. The big technology companies, Skype, Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, everyone else in those slides, they've all been participating in creating and contributing data to these profiles that the NSA is going to be using that new Utah data center for.
Right.
That is supposed to be able to collect your information and information of basically everyone on the planet for the next 500 years. The storage capacity is in yodabytes, Y-O-D-D-A, I think, or
yodabytes. Right.
Right. Look that up.
I know, it's crazy. And we're paying for our own enslavement. We're paying for that.
Understand that the word Google, G-O-O-G-O-L, look it up on the Google, it means everything. It basically means infinity. It means 10 to the 100th power, I believe, which if you look, you know, there's not too many things in the universe if the universe itself has that many parts.
Right. Right?
So, come on. I mean, they're writing it out there. And their slogan used to be, don't be evil or whatever. Come on. Like, come on. I never believed that. And I said it in Project Constellation in 2006. I said Google was an NSA project. I said that the Verizon and NSA, they're all the same thing. And you have to act as if. Don't ever say anything through electronic communication, even if it's encrypted, that you don't want published on the front page of a paper.
Absolutely.
Or presented in a lawsuit against you later when they try to use all that data and construct a crime because you're inconvenient to their truth.
Exactly. That movie Minority Report comes to mind. But, you know, today, this past week, it's become clear that the Drug Enforcement Agency, the DEA, is now using the information that they've spied on people on their phones and whatnot to press charges against you, to just come in your house and arrest you for what you may have thought, said, or did.
I saw that, and I saw it on Reuters, and I'm like, wow, when Reuters is reporting this stuff, like, they're just really like, hey, we're doing it, everybody, and nothing has changed. Like, Snowden came out, nobody's behavior changed, everyone still uses the same things in the same naive ways, and they don't really get it, and they're just testing the fences with us. That's what these stories are out there for. That's why you found out about Snowden and not Thomas Drake.
Right.
Look up Thomas Drake on YouTube, watch what he's about. He was charged with espionage. For his so-called leak or whistleblowing or however you want to classify it. Start listening to the message. Don't, you know, take me as a person out of it. What did I say that is relevant to you and human history? Take that. Work on that. Take what's meaningful. Discard the rest.
Right.
Arbitrary. Focus on the substantial.
Right, but we live in a society where they want to shoot the messenger. They don't pay attention to the message. They want to shoot the messenger. Oh,
right.
He's anti-American. He's this, he's that.
Anyone who ever, you know, wants to focus on the messenger and not the message is employing fallacies and trying to deceive you. So I say take all your energy and focus on them, because that's where the lie is coming through to you, through them. Start there.
Right. Absolutely.
Use these messages of truth to find the truth and how it connects to you in your life and make it meaningful.
Well said, Richard. And on that note, that pretty much concludes our time together. And as usual, a very interesting show. So thank you so much, Rich.
Thank you so much to you, Maria, and to everyone listening.
Good. I look forward to our next show. Take good care.
You too. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Richard Grove. Get over and check out his work, tragedyandhope.com. All his other websites link through that same site. He's got quite the education on his site. So support people supporting you. See you guys
tomorrow.
Thank you
for listening and supporting the Maria Show. Tell others what you learned today. Knowledge becomes wisdom only when it's shared. Encourage others to subscribe today. www.maria.net. Often imitated, never duplicated. A world of information all in one place. www.maria.net. Always ahead of the curve. Always on your side. Get active or get radioactive. Subscribe today.